Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know?
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia theme song. We're back for another hour in Solartopia. We have two great guests to talk with us about nuclear power, how we get rid of it, and what we need to do to get to Solartopia in the world of energy. We have Kevin Camp from Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, you with us?
Hi, Harvey.
Hey, how are you? Good to talk with you as always. And Cynthia Papermaster from Code Pink. Cynthia, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here in Berkeley. Nice to talk to you.
And we're doing the transcoastal thing again. Kevin, you're in Washington, D.C. I am in Teaneck, New Jersey, at my daughter's house. After a weekend of family festivities, and Cynthia, you are on the left coast, as they say. So we're going to spend the hour talking about nuclear power and other things related to getting Solartopia in the world of energy. And Kevin, you've been kind enough to join us at the last minute. Cynthia and I, we have had this plan for a while. And what I'd like to do, Cynthia, is start with you, and Kevin, please jump in, being the great expert you are on things nuclear. Tell us, Cynthia, you have on the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant issue. You are working in the early stages of a rate revolt, or as we call it, an irate rate revolt, to force Pacific Gas and Electric to hand on the nuclear power plants, the two reactors at Diablo Canyon. Now, you in Berkeley, in the Bay Area, you are a PG&E rate payer, as are most of the people in the Bay Area. Tell us what you have going here on this idea of a rate revolt.
Okay. PG&E is a corporation that depends on ratepayers. They depend on their customers to function, and they need to show a profit. And one thing we thought about in terms of closing Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, which is the last California nuke and a very dangerous, very, very dangerous plant, reactors there, we thought we'd try to affect their bottom line by organizing a ratepayer revolt. So we're just asking people at this point to pledge not to pay their PG&E bill. And instead of paying their PG&E bill, they'll send the payments to an escrow account, and we'll hold their money in an escrow account for them. We're gathering lots of pledges to make that ratepayer revolt successful. When we have about 400 pledges, we thought, and we can adjust this number if we want, but what we thought we would do when we got about 400 pledges is to activate the revolt and start sending our money to the escrow account. So this is an attempt to pressure PG&E and to show them the seriousness of our opposition to Diablo.
Well, aside from showing them the seriousness of it, what kind of impact do you realistically think you can have in terms of PG&E's financial well-being and their willingness to shut or not shut the Diablo Canyon reactors?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I don't know what PG&E's financial statements look like. I don't know how they're doing financially. I'm hearing a little echo on my end. Are you hearing that as well? Or
no, you're good.
Okay. My phone. I think they're a pretty sound company. I know they've had a lot of difficulties lately with the different scandals, legal scandals and criminal scandals going on with PG&E, but I think they're pretty healthy financially. What effect can we have on their bottom line? Well, that remains to be seen. I think if we get 100, 200, 400, 500, thousands of pledges and people actually stop sending their money to PG&E, it could have quite an effect on them. they could be very, they could react very strongly to that. They might, well, they certainly would have to tell their shareholders that there's less money coming in, but they would, they might have to go to the California Public Utilities Commission and ask to raise the rates. I mean, that's one concern that somebody shared with me the other day. Is that a possibility? But it really remains to be seen. I'd love to turn the question around and ask you what you think.
Well, let's ask Kevin Kamps first. Kevin Kamps from the Beyond Nuclear. You've been in this anti-nuclear movement for many, many, many years. Is there any history of a rate revolt having an impact on a nuclear provider?
Oh, man, I think the nuclear utility companies live in fear of their ratepayers. I mean, one of the best examples I can think of is in Sacramento, where the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, by popular vote, after Chernobyl, voted to shut down Rancho Seco atomic reactor. So, you know, in addition to living in fear of their own ratepayers, I think what really gets these folks out of bed in the morning, and this is really kind of a quote from Chris Williams up in Vermont, who's been in the middle of shutting down the Vermont Yankee reactor, the thing that gets nuclear utility executives out of bed in the morning is how much money they're going to make that day. So when people start taking away that money, which gets them out of bed in the morning, they're definitely going to take notice.
So are you saying that we want a rate revolt so that the utility executives will stay in bed?
You know, if those folks could sleep as long as Rip Van Winkle, it'd probably be good for the planet if they just took a long nap, because they're doing a lot of damage to this planet.
Well, amen to that. And we do want to mention, by the way, you mentioned Chris Williams, a great activist. I knew him in Indiana. He moved to Vermont, and he was instrumental, as were you, and some of the other great people like Deb Katz, in the imminent, in progress, shutdown, permanent shutdown of the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. So I don't know if we can give you a standing ovation here on a radio show, but you certainly deserve it, and all the great people.
Oh, man. Well, geez, I mean, 40-plus years of citizen activism in Vermont, and, you know, it's just, it's the sweetest of the shutdowns. No offense whatsoever to San Onofre in California, but, man, people have worked for, you know, over 40 years at Vermont Yankee, and December 29th is the last day. There are celebrations planned. There's going to be a Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Alliance potluck celebration on, I think it's the 27th in Montpelier. And then on January 3rd, I think in Western Mass is where it's going to happen. There's going to be kind of a Brattleboro area celebration. So folks are going to, you know, very rightfully celebrate.
Well, will there be any pot at this potluck? Medicinal, no doubt. Okay. So, yes, Vermont Yankee going down is a huge deal. And you also mentioned San Onofre. Now, the two reactors at San Onofre shut last year, and that was also the product of a tremendous amount of citizen action. Cynthia and Kevin, jump in on this. What do you think the role was in the shutdown of the two reactors at San Onofre of citizen action and of campaigns like this rate revolt?
That was mainly, I mean, from what I know, it's mainly citizen action that motivated and energized the whole San Onofre shutdown. I recently met Diana Gilmore, a citizen who, as an IT professional moving down to the area where San Onofre was, shared with me that she loved the area so much, but she noticed there was a nuclear power plant there, and it scared her, and she got involved. She started learning about the issues around nuclear power and how could we shut this plant, and that was her her big goal, and I was just really honored to meet her, because here's a citizen who took it upon herself to get informed and get energized around this and organize others. And I know she wasn't alone in this. Ace Hoffman was another person who was very, very much involved. You know, and I'm new to the anti-nuclear movement. I'm an absolute new person on this. I don't really know very much. I'm learning as I go. But I was recently in Washington, D.C. at the Sierra Club National Conference on a Nuclear-Free Future. You were there too, Harvey. And Donna Gilmore was there, and she spoke. And I was so impressed with her. She's now one of the foremost experts in the country on nuclear waste storage canisters. She's even spoken with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about that. But I'm looking at her, and she's such an incredible role model. I'm just a citizen. I'm just a PG&E ratepayer. I am an activist as well, and I've learned a lot from Code Pink in that. But citizens have to do this. It's certainly not the government that's going to do it for us. The government is negligent. All of the agencies that are regulating nuclear power are not doing their job. Certainly with Diablo, that's the case, and I know with San Onofre the same way. So it's citizens who have to rise up now. We have to put pressure on them. We have to work together on the various strategic ways of doing that in the courts, in the hearing rooms, protests, occupies, every which way. And this ratepayer revolt is one thing that I think could really succeed, and it's certainly going to contribute. But I'm willing to give my all to this. I'm willing myself to have PG&E come and cut off my power if that's what it's going to take. I mean, I am really frightened of what could happen with Diablo. I think it's a real serious problem that we can't afford to ignore. And I hope to inspire other citizens to rise up as well. We need everybody in this, or a lot of people anyway, a lot of people with good energy. And it's a beautiful thing to work on, Harvey. I just have to say, and you know this very well too, being active about issues that are facing us is the thing that can give us hope, real hope. It's the thing that can make life worth living. So I'm happy to be doing this. I'm overjoyed to be doing this and working with people like yourself on this.
Well, Cynthia Papermaster, I brought you on the show in part because you are, I have to say, I've been watching Orange is the New Black. Have you guys seen Orange is the New Black? And it's about a woman who goes into prison, and they call her a newbie. So you refer to yourself, I'm going to call you a newbie as well. You're still wearing your orange jumpsuit as opposed to the khakis they give the longtime prisoners. But this is the opposite of going into a prison. This is really finding one's freedom and activism. And Kevin, you've been an activist for God knows how long.
I just celebrated my half-life probably a year ago. So for half my life, I'm 45. So I'm about 22, 23 years into this thing. And one of the first anti-nuclear power events I ever went to was this guy named Harvey Wasserman speaking in my hometown, Kalamazoo, Michigan. And that really deepened the hook. I'd worked on nuclear weapons for a year or two before that, but you helped sway me over to the nuclear power side of the coin. And, it's been a quarter century now.
All right. Well, since you both raised this idea of new activists, I'm going to have to tell a story. I have a vague recollection of that talk in Kalamazoo. You know, when you move around and you speak in local groups, it's hard to distinguish or remember specific events. Every once in a while, you look out and you've traveled all day and you're talking to 10 or 15 people. Cynthia, are you there?
I am here, yeah.
Okay, so you got to stick with it here. So, at any rate, I once talked with Jeremy Rifkin, the great Jeremy Rifkin, about the perils of being on the road and doing this kind of speaking work. And I told him that I once flew from Miami to Duluth and spoke to five people. And he, Jeremy Rifkin, who now speaks to prime ministers and goes all over the world on these issues, told me that it was a long time he wouldn't fly. And he traveled from Washington, D.C. to Denver and spoke to two people. And he said, but, you got to give the whole speech and you got to do the whole thing because one of those people might be a Gandhi. And, with both of you, I feel that way. I told that story, by the way, for a couple months ago, and for the first time, I've been telling that story for years, somebody jumped up and said, that's not an original line to Jeremy Rifkin. Because in one of his books, Bertrand Russell, the great peace activist, the great British peace activist, said that he called a big public meeting, and one person, showed up, but it actually was Gandhi. So there you go. You never know what you're going to do in this work. Same as we never know who's listening on this radio station. If someone listening to the show could be the person who makes the final difference in shutting these nuclear plants.
So there's a story from Dr. Spock, Dr. Benjamin Spock, who, you know, became huge in the anti-nuclear weapons movement, that he came out of the White House and saw a group of women strike for peace. This was way back. This was in the 50s. And he was so moved because they were in a pouring rainstorm, and it was a small group of women holding signs, that he was moved to take the issue more seriously. And it was, you know, an important moment for him. So it turns out that one of those women felt like this was just the end for her, you know. They didn't know each other, and they didn't talk at that moment, but the stories came together. I think it might have been Rebecca Solnit who brought the two stories together. And, you know, the woman thought in utter despair, what are we doing out here? And little did she know that Dr. Benjamin Spock was taking their protest very seriously.
Yeah, and I actually, my first arrest, first purposeful arrest. I've been arrested before for other stuff, but my first activist arrest was in 1980 at the Pentagon with Benjamin Spock. And I figured since my mother used his book to raise me, it was certainly appropriate that my first arrest would come with my baby doctor, and that was one of the great things too. So let's proceed here. First, let's talk about Diablo Canyon. Now, last week I had Linda Seeley and Damon Moglen. Linda from the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, and Damon from Friends of the Earth. And they are pursuing a legal challenge to the license at Diablo Canyon. Kevin, do you want to give us a little more detail on that?
Well, there was also a great hearing held by Senator Barbara Boxer, the chairwoman of the Environment and Public Works Committee in the U.S. Senate, on December 3rd, and that shed a lot of light on these issues. The issue is that what Friends of the Earth and Mothers for Peace are bringing forward is that Diablo Canyon is not designed to survive the earthquake that could happen there. So when they built this plant decades ago, they knew of some of the fault lines in the area, but they sure didn't know about all of them. And over the decades, and even within recent years, more fault lines have come to light. And in fact, the most recent revelations, just, you know, within weeks, have been that the fault lines are much longer than were known before, and in fact, they're connected to each other. And so the earthquake potential at Diablo Canyon is much worse than that plant is designed for. And God forbid, if these fault lines line up and the big one comes, this plant is vulnerable. And so Friends of the Earth and Mothers for Peace want there to be public hearings, just like Friends of the Earth demanded at San Onofre on the steam generators, the defective steam generator replacements. They want to hold hearings on the deficiency of Diablo Canyon in regards to earthquake risks. And this is the very issue that an NRC staff person brought to light through a differing professional opinion. He said this plant should be shut down until it can be proven safe.
Linda, I'm sorry, Cynthia, are you following that as well in the Bay Area?
Yeah, absolutely. I watched the whole Boxer hearing, for example, and was very impressed with how she questioned the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the fact that she and other Senator Markey were also doing this, but they haven't implemented any of the 12 safety measures they asked the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to implement after Fukushima. They had come up with a list of 12 things they wanted to make sure our nuclear plants were safe after they saw what happened at Fukushima, and it turned out that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hasn't done any of those steps. So it doesn't give us a lot of faith in our Nuclear Regulatory Commission to see that. Of course, the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has resigned and is leaving. Someone else will become the chair. And then the second half of her hearing was three experts, two of whom said that were opposed to Diablo continuing to operate. They were very aware of the safety issues there. One of them was a lifelong Republican who I think had represented that district in the California State Senate. Blakesley, I believe his name was. The other gentleman was a professor. His last name was Hirsch. And then they had what I consider an apologist from the nuclear industry who said, oh, Diablo, you know, it's perfectly safe. You know, what are you guys talking about? So I was very excited to see the hearing that Boxer held. My question is, what's next? I really wish and hope that we can get some kind of concerted effort to get her to take the next step now, which is to shut it, at least temporarily, or shut it, like they did San Onofre. And I think we have to speak up now and try to organize some kind of concerted effort to get her to take that move. What was your question, though?
Well, the problem now we have is that Senator Boxer is no longer going to be the chair of that committee because the Republicans are coming in.
Yeah.
And God forbid, God knows what they're going to do. Kevin, being in Washington, who is going to take over the chairpersonship of the committee that Senator Boxer has been running?
Well, it's very difficult to tell. As soon as Chairman McFarland leaves on January 1st, that's going to mean there's an open seat on the commission. There's five seats at the commission. And the new people who just got appointed recently, Barron, who's a former Hill staffer, he worked for Waxman in the House and had a hand in the Waxman-Markey bill of 2009, which was pro-renewables, very skeptical of nuclear. He had a huge hand in the writing of that legislation, and now he's on the commission. He just in recent days was reappointed by Democrats at the committee level to a five-year seat where his seat was going to expire next year before. So Boxer made the offhand remark at the hearing that she called him Chairman Barron at one point, and then she said, I only wish it could be so. And the other new person is Burns. These are Obama nominated commissioners who've been approved. They're on the commission. The question is, will Obama tap one of them to be chair when McFarland leaves, or is there a new person who is going to be nominated who would become the chairman? And the thing is, time is running out for the Democrats for that latter option, because the power turns over to the Republicans on January 6th. It's going to be very difficult to get Senate confirmation by then. So what could happen is there's an empty seat on the commission, and it could turn into 2-2 votes, even if the Democrats take one side of an issue and the Republicans take the other, because there's two Republicans on the commission. That's Zinicki and Ostendorf. And, you know, the chess game gets crazy complicated, because 2-2 votes mean the status quo prevails. And the status quo on many of these issues, like at Diablo on seismic risks, is not good. And so for the nuclear industry and their many friends, like every single member of the Republican Party in the U.S. Congress, status quo is good. They can keep things the way they are. To change things, to try to make them better, takes a majority on the commission, and that's the challenge.
Well, and of course, we know that one of the very worst commissioners in the history of the NRC was a Democrat, William Magwood.
Yes.
Thankfully, he's gone now. And we also know that when we did have a decent chairman, Yasko, Greg Yasko, they basically crucified the guy and, you know, just ran him out of town because he dared to question the nuclear industry.
And what's incredible about that, I think our board member, Carl Grossman, who's an investigative journalist on nuclear power issues for decades, put it really well when Yasko was crucified or beheaded, however you want to put it.
Yeah.
He was insufficiently pro-nuclear for the likes of industry. And the reason he said that, and it's true, is Yasko only voted our way about a third of the time. The other two-thirds of the time, just as one example, at Palisades in southwest Michigan, where I'm from, Yasko, with a unanimous commission, voted to extend the license by 20 years up there. So he voted against us way more than he voted for us. And because of certain things like his previous service for Senator Reid opposing the Yucca dump, for invoking emergency powers as chairman after the Fukushima catastrophe began, which was his right by law, for those kinds of things, he was, you know, handed his head back on a platter by the nuclear power industry. And that's the crazy thing is, you know, we've had very few friends on the commission over the decades. I mean, names like Bradford or Galinsky, or to an extent Yasko, will stand out. But, you know, even McFarland, man, I'm so disappointed in her. She voted the right way a couple, three times in the last couple years. She voted to expedite the transfer of spent nuclear fuel out of these catastrophically vulnerable pools. She voted to put filters on Mark 1 and Mark 2 boiling water reactors like Fukushima's design. And you're starting to run out of things she did right in the last couple years. So it's just, you know, the industry controls the NRC.
Could I ask a question at some point?
Yes, Cynthia, please.
Yeah, I just wondered about that statement that no Republicans are opposed to nuclear power. The reason I'm bringing that up is that we recently had a meeting in Washington, D.C. with Ralph Nader, whose new book, Unstoppable, Forming a Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State, is something I'm real excited about. I'm excited about that strategy. And he shared with me, because I'm trying to actually do this, is to form a left-right alliance to dismantle the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. And I'm wondering if we have allies among those on the right. And so he actually gave me a couple names of people here in California who I could contact, and I'm planning to do that. But I'm just wondering about that statement. Can you actually say that with certainty, that no Republicans are opposed to nuclear power? I mean, there was a Republican in that Senate hearing. One of the best people who testified was a Republican saying that he was opposed to Diablo.
Yeah, you're right. He was a former state senator from California, Blakeslee, who, you know, has some real questions. But he went out of his way during his testimony there to say he's not anti-nuclear, you know, but he's very concerned about the seismic issues at Diablo. Which is a, you know, a responsible thing. He's a seismologist, too. I mean, I'm talking about the U.S. Congress. I'm talking about present day. It's been very rare, and I've been in D.C. for 15 years now. It's been very rare for a Republican in either the U.S. House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate to take any position that challenges the nuclear power industry in any way. It's a very rare thing. There have been some exceptions, like at Indian Point in New York, where a Republican member of the U.S. House of Representatives who is Republican is concerned about safety risks and will say it out loud in public, but it's such a rare exception. So we've got a lot of work to do on the Republican side of the aisle on these matters.
I'm just trying to step away from this dichotomy that we seem to be living in, which is Republican bad, Democrat good. I'm with Harvey. I think the Democrats have done horrible things to the United States, and they've gone along with a lot of things that are just horrible, which is, I think, the next topic we're going to bring up. But I want to see people as allies. I want to give them the benefit of the doubt as much as possible and not cut off a whole huge group of potential allies by saying we're not going to talk to them or we're not going to have hope that they can work with us, because I want to work with them.
Well, let's hope that some of the Republicans turn up on our side on this issue, but certainly the Democrats have not been as in fact, Obama has still been somewhat pro-nuclear. I do want to say we're with Cynthia Papermaster, Code Pink, who's in Berkeley and has started a ratepayer revolt campaign to help shut the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors, and Kevin Camps, been on the show many times, from the Beyond Nuclear organization in Washington, D.C. I did want to mention, but we're going to take a short break, but I did want to mention that the Los Angeles Times today has run a front-page story on the potential impact of earthquakes on the aqueducts that go into L.A. And, you know, the entire human presence in Los Angeles is dependent on water brought in from outside the area. I mean, they're all right, there shouldn't be any human beings living there at all. It's a desert. And the L.A. Times has warned that there are very, very many vulnerable places in the aqueduct system that could be impacted by an earthquake. And hopefully they'll make the people of California will make the connection of what could happen to Diablo Canyon, which is, by the way, half as far from the San Andreas Fault as was the Fukushima reactor complex from the earthquake epicenter that destroyed it. So on that happy note, let's take a short break with my buddy Dana Lyons. We'll come back in about 3 minutes and talk further with Kevin Camps and Cynthia Papermaster on nuclear and other issues.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solar.
Yeah, that's my buddy Dana Lyons singing the Soarotopia song. We're back for another half hour of the Soarotopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I've got two great guests with me, Cynthia Papermaster of Code Pink, who has launched a ratepayer revolt against the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors, and my buddy Kevin Camp's been on the show many times talking about all things nuclear power. Kevin, you put out on the Internet a discussion of a new GAO report on various cost accounting measures employed by the regulators on nuclear power. You want to tell us a bit about that?
Sure. We're actually pretty concerned about it. At first blush, when you read the news article, it would seem like, yeah, GAO, which is the investigative arm of Congress, is putting pressure on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do a better job at estimating, calculating how bad the consequences would be downwind of a meltdown, for example, at a atomic reactor. But both Congressman Upton, who's the Republican chair incoming, again, of the Energy and Commerce Committee on the House side, and David Vitter, who's the Republican senator from Louisiana, who's probably going to chair the Nuclear Power Subcommittee on the Senate Environment Public Works Committee, they both declared victory on this GAO report. And they said, see, regulations are too costly. The safety benefits are not worth the cost. And so I haven't had a chance to study the GAO report, but it looks like, you know, the NRC was quoted in this news article saying, yeah, you know, these Congress people are right. We need to look back at our cost benefit analyses and do a better job. What that means in that Orwellian nuke speak is they're going to try to cut more corners on safety and put the risk on the public, you know. And I just, before coming on the show, I looked up the numbers that back then Representative Markey, now Senator Markey, forced the NRC to admit publicly back in 1982. This is a report called CRAC-2, which is short for Calculation for Reactor Accident Consequences. And I looked up the numbers on Diablo Canyon, Units 1 and 2. And put your seatbelts on. Back in 1982, Congressman Markey, with subpoena powers, forced the NRC, who wanted to suppress this information, to let be known how many peak early fatalities could happen at Diablo Canyon. At both units, 10,000 peak early fatalities if there were to be a meltdown. So if both units went up, it'd be 20,000 peak early fatalities. The next category is peak early injuries, 11,000 at Unit 1, 12,000 at Unit 2, that's 23,000 peak early injuries. Peak cancer deaths, which is latent cancer deaths, 12,000 at each unit. So you add them up, that's 24,000. And then get these property damages. These are in 1982 dollars, $155 billion at Unit 1, $158 billion at Unit 2. When you adjust for inflation, you're talking $368 billion, $375 billion. You add it all up, that's $743 billion in property damages. And those casualty figures are lowballs. I mean, remember, this was an NRC-commissioned report that they tried to conceal. It was carried out by Sandia National Lab, which is no lefty tree-hugger institution either. These are lowball figures. And, of course, in the last 40 years since this report came out, because they based it on 1970 census data, even though it was a 1982 report, the population has soared around Diablo Canyon. So these are huge figures, and NRC is going to try to downplay them yet again.
Well, Cynthia Papermaster, you are a regular visitor to the San Luis Obispo area, and you know, one thing we have to understand about these casualty numbers is that the owner and operator of the two reactors at Diablo Canyon, these are very large reactors, by the way. They're 1,200 megawatts plus, each one of them. They're as big as pretty much any in the world. And if they, God forbid, have a major accident, we know that PG&E is not responsible for any of it. I mean, there's really no accountability to the perpetrators of these disasters. Is that correct, Cynthia?
That, you know, actually, I thought that too, but I was corrected recently. There's some limit to the liability, but they have a little bit of liability, financial liability, as I understand
it.
Yeah,
$12 billion. I think that's right, isn't it, Kevin? The federal fund
is around $12 billion. That's their limit. And then beyond that, it's taxpayers' responsibility.
Right, right.
So $12 billion, but that $12 billion is in a fund that is shared by all the nuclear utilities. So PG&E's own contribution to the liability fund is minuscule compared to the amount of damage that would be done, and they are simply insulated from that kind of damage, from that liability.
And that law, the Price-Anderson Act, was supposed to be a 10-year-long law to get the fledgling nuclear power industry off the ground onto its own two feet. It was passed in 1957, and, you know, we're looking at the sixth decade since passage. It's been renewed out to 2025, so unless Congress were to repeal the extension, they're good to go until 2025, and they will try to extend it again at that point.
Yeah.
Now, Cynthia, we just had a major fatal incident that was perpetrated by PG&E in San Bruno, California. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Because PG&E was trying to save some money, it didn't fix some gas lines that served the San Bruno area, which is just south of San Francisco. And they went for years without repairing these lines. And then there was a giant explosion. I think 8 people died in that. There was a huge fire and explosion. It was a disaster. And so after years and years of investigation and so forth, finally there's been a settlement in this case. What's interesting to me is they're responsible for this disaster, but the California Public Utilities Commission chair, Michael Peavy, was asked to find a judge who'd be favorable to a small settlement for PG&E, a much smaller settlement than maybe people were, than people deserved. And he was caught shopping for a judge. I'm just going off on a tangent a little bit, but because I think this is really important. He was caught shopping for a judge for PG&E. PG&E asked him to find a favorable judge. He went out and did it, and he admitted it in an email that came to light. And then there was this flurry of outrage over that, because that's illegal to do that. Now, Michael Peavy's resigned just a few weeks ago from being the chair of the California Public Utilities Commission. I don't know who's going to take his place, but he's also got a lot of other criminal accusations swirling around him. There's a Credo petition right now to get Kamala Harris, our Secretary of State here in California, our Attorney General here in California, to file a prosecution against him. So maybe he's going to be facing that. So PG&E was negligent there. And there's many other instances of PG&E's negligence. Diablo Canyon is a glaring one in my view. They are negligent. They're out of compliance with so many regulations at Diablo Canyon. And I wanted to say, in reference to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and what's going to happen there and the Republicans taking over the Senate and so forth, we have an opportunity here in California to get the California State Water Resources Board to act on Diablo. They could close Diablo. And I recently went to a hearing. Well, it wasn't a hearing. They characterized it as a chat. And at this chat, PG&E made a presentation, and the company they hired to do a report on the once-through cooling system at Diablo and whether or not they should be required to build cooling towers there. They don't have cooling towers. Bechtel Corporation presented a report on how expensive it would be to build cooling towers and how it would cause disruptions to the plant's operation if they had construction going on there and so forth. And so that was PG&E and Bechtel's presentation. And then we had wonderful groups like Friends of the Earth who were there, and the group that Rochelle Becker is a part of, and I can't remember their name. Harvey, what is it?
Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility.
Yeah, okay. So they were there, and their wonderful attorney, Giesman, John Giesman, was there. There were Mothers for Peace there at that water board chat as well. And we heard, and the water board went till, I think, 9 o'clock at night listening to all of the testimony and all of the people who came there to speak. And I was very heartened by that. And I don't know much about the water board, but it seems to me that they were really, truly listening respectfully to what everyone had to say, allowing everyone to say their piece. I got up and said, people haven't been talking about this, but the water that's used to cool Diablo goes back out into the ocean hot, and we've heard that it's killing marine life for 500 miles. What we haven't heard about is what is in that water. If there's tritium in the water or there's other sort of toxic things in the water, and people are going to Avila Beach nearby, and they're playing out there with their kids in the water and everything. Shouldn't there be some kind of warning? Shouldn't there be some kind of concern over the health effects of that, too? You know, it's something the water board should consider. And I also said, please, you know, enforce the regulations that you have. Don't continue to give Diablo an exemption from building cooling towers. You know, it's clearly not working. We have all this documentation that it's not working, that that marine life's being killed, you know, there's no reason to give them an exemption any further. So I'm hoping that they'll soon have a hearing and come down on the right side on that.
Well, first of all, Cynthia Papermaster, you mentioned Michael Peavy, the outgoing head of the California Public Utilities Commission. And I have to say and tell our listeners that you actually personally played a role in that. You confronted him at a public setting and handed him a pink slip. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. My colleague, Jiminy Winks, who's my little service animal, and I, before the hearing got underway, the last hearing, we went up to the dais where the PUC commissioners were sitting, and I shook his hand. I said, I'm Cynthia Papermaster. And then I publicly pink slipped him, which is something, a tactic that Code Pink uses to get the message out about people who shouldn't be sitting in those seats. You know,
he really should resign,
and I told him that publicly. It got filmed, and it's just a wonderful little, took about 30 seconds to do, but I think it did contribute to his decision to resign. I hope so.
You are the person that fired Michael Peavy, and
we're
honored to have you on the show.
I wish he
changed his name, because Peavy, of course, also stands for Portable TX Cells, which we hope are going to be replacing all the nuclear plants in the world. Now, you also mentioned the California Water Board. I was going to talk. I don't think we have time today. I was going to talk to you about torture. So we want to make it clear to our listeners that there's a difference between the California Water Board and waterboarding, which is brought to us by Dick Cheney. You know, it's a form of torture. Now, the California Water Board, there is a regulation on the California books, as there is in New Jersey and in New York, a number of other states about the water quality, the quality of the water that can be put in and the temperature of the water.
5-7.
That can be emitted into rivers, lakes, oceans, and streams from power plants, including nuclear plants. Now, the Diablo Canyon reactors are out of compliance with state regulations in terms of how hot the water is, and yet this is not being enforced. And if it were enforced, the owners of Diablo Canyon would be forced to build cooling towers to make the water cooler before it goes into the ocean. And, Kevin, we have experience with this situation in New Jersey at Oyster Creek. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting matter of nuclear power plants facing closure for lack of cooling towers. So at Oyster Creek, New Jersey, which is the oldest operating reactor in the country, it's a Fukushima twin. It's a GE BWR Mark I. Unfortunately, Governor Christie compromised with the company, which is Exelon out of Chicago, and said, hey, instead of 20 extra years on your original 40-year license, we'll only give you 10, and you won't have to build cooling towers. Because what's incredible at Oyster Creek is once every 6 weeks, every ounce of water in Barnegat Bay passes through the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant for cooling. It's a very small bay. It's very shallow. And Oyster Creek is frying Barnegat Bay. So it is violating the Clean Water Act. And, you know, that plant should have been shut down a long time ago. It should not have gotten a 20-year extension. It should not have gotten a 10-year extension. Up in New York State, the State of New York Environment Agency is requiring Entergy to install cooling towers 40 years too late at Indian Point Units 2 and 3, which are also having huge impacts on the Hudson River fisheries. And, yeah, Diablo, my coworkers Paul and Linda Gunter, about 15 years ago wrote a report called License to Kill with a chapter on Diablo. There are before and after photos of what the heat discharges from Diablo have done to Diablo Cove. It was an underwater oasis, a jungle of life. And after startup, they scalded it, and it's now bare rock. And that was directly due to the 25-degree Fahrenheit temperature increase. So you know, if the Clean Water Act is upheld, then these nuclear power plants without cooling towers would be forced to shut down.
Well, assuming that the government does its job. And I want to point out that there are indications now, clear indications, and Cynthia, maybe you might have more detailed knowledge, that since the San Onofre has shut and the hot water from those two reactors has stopped pouring into the ocean, that there's actually been noticeable recovery among some of the ecosystems near the San Onofre reactors. Have you heard anything specific about that, Cynthia?
I have not, but I'm delighted to entertain the thought. That would be great.
Right, and we have to, when we talk about San Onofre, you know, we did have, you mentioned Donna Gilmore and Ace Hoffman. We've had, in a, along with Friends of the Earth and other groups, decades of activism there. But the people who originally fought San Onofre were surfers. It's apparently one of the best surfing beaches on the West Coast, and hopefully people are now enjoying the surfing there without the radioactive impacts that they've been suffering so long. Now, there are a number of other issues at Diablo Canyon, and there's my dog Samson, barking in the background, that are really coming to light, including some rate issues. Cynthia, have you been following the rate cases around Diablo Canyon?
No. Please tell us.
Okay. Well, we hope that your rate revolt will have some impact on that. Kevin, what else? Nationwide, what are you are speculating that the next reactors that are vulnerable to shutdown will be? We're hoping that Diablo Canyon will be on the list, but what is looking imminent now in terms of the nuclear shutdown?
Well, there was a really inspiring report written by Dr. Mark Cooper of Vermont Law School. It would have been the summer of 2013 already when he wrote this, and he identified the reactors in the country that are most at economic risk of shutdown. And like we talked about earlier, if these companies aren't making money, then they're going to shut down. And we saw that at Kewaunee, Wisconsin, where, you know, it had a 20-year license extension, which it had just started. It had 20 more years of license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but its operating costs made it uneconomic versus the competition from wind power and unfortunately from fracked natural gas. And we're seeing that across the country. And so Mark Cooper identified Vermont Yankee, which is shutting down on December 29th of this year, and a whole list of reactors. And so, you know, the ones I'm following the most closely would include ones like Palisades in Michigan, which is on life support because it got a really good power purchase agreement with the state approval, unfortunately. But there are reactors that don't have those in place, these so-called merchant plants, a lot of them in the Northeast. And so, you know, you've also got the Exelon fleet in Illinois. And there are, according to Cooper, there were close to 40 reactors that were right on the edge. And he identified a dozen that were most vulnerable. Another of the dozen besides Palisades that I'm working on includes Davis-Bessey in Ohio, which has a cracked containment like Crystal River in Florida, which was its death knell, but it also has an experimental steam generator replacement that's just underway. That's the same issue that took down San Onofre units 2 and 3, so it's got all that at one atomic reactor. And then you've got, you know, the ancient GE BWR Mark I's, the Fukushima twins. We mentioned Oyster Creek. There are any number of those, 23 across the country. One that we're challenging right now is Spermi Unit 2 in southeast Michigan, the last of the Mark I's not to get its license extension yet. The other 22 have. And I think one of our biggest challenges in these shutdown campaigns is that the NRC is in collusion with the nuclear industry in a very bad way. And that's a choice word because the Japanese parliament concluded after an independent investigation that collusion between regulator, industry, and elected officials was the root cause of the Fukushima catastrophe. And just one example to bring it back to Diablo Canyon, just today Friends of the Earth put out a press release documenting that the NRC Office of Public Affairs was in collusion with, was colluding with PG&E on the release of reports about the seismic risks at Diablo Canyon. This just happened recently. So there's collusion in spades in this country between the NRC and the nuclear utilities and unfortunately way too many of our elected officials, like in the U.S. Congress.
Yes, and Cynthia, I'm sure that these reports of collusion between the regulatory agencies and the and PG&E operating at Diablo Canyon have been having their impact across the state. And we're hoping that they will lead to shutdowns. We've been talking with Kevin Camps of the Beyond Nuclear Organization in Washington, D.C., great experts on the ongoing struggle to rid our planet of nuclear power plants, and Cynthia Papermaster of Code Pink in Berkeley, California, also working on a rate revolt against Pacific Gas and Electric. I do want to point out, which owns Diablo Canyon, that these reactors, and we're not really clear, are we, Cynthia, on whether or not Diablo is losing money. I've heard many rumors in California saying that that Diablo Canyon is actually now operating at a loss. Have you heard such reports?
No, I've heard it spoken about. I've also heard the opposite, that PG&E is doing well. I think I heard that from that expert who testified at the Boxer Environment Committee hearing, that they were doing well. But I don't know if he's correct or not. I don't know what's correct there. We should find out, definitely find that out.
So the bottom line is that, Kevin, you mentioned reactors in Illinois that are losing money, and in Ohio. And what's happening now is that the owners of these reactors, after telling the universe that nuclear power would be too cheap to meter, they're now going into state legislatures and begging for bailouts to continue operating these deadly reactors. And they're also getting anti-solar legislation. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it's incredible. And Tim Judson at Nuclear Information and Resource Service wrote a great report some months ago called Killing the Competition. And it's about the nuclear power industry's war that it has declared against renewable energy in this country. And this is happening at the federal level and at the state level. So at the federal level, for example, with the EPA climate rule that the deadline for public comment just ended on December 1st, companies like Exelon are having huge sway at the federal EPA and seeking subsidies from this EPA policy. At the same time, Exelon is turning to the Illinois State Legislature looking for subsidies there. We're seeing the same thing with First Energy in Ohio, trying to get subsidies for coal plants and nuclear plants. And what's really ironic, again, Chris Williams with Citizens Awareness Network in the Northeast pointed out that he was in Indiana and at the meetings with companies, the forerunners of Exelon and the forerunner of Entergy, and they were the ones who hammered out their lobbyists demanded deregulation back in the 1990s because they thought they could gouge more money out of the American people for nuclear power. They could charge a competitive price for it. Well, now they're begging for bailouts because they can't compete. They can't compete with wind. They can't compete with solar. They certainly can't compete with efficiency. They can't even compete with fracked natural gas, and they're going out of business, these merchant plants that they set up this policy. So the battle is on, and it is a war for the future of energy. Are we going to recommit to these obsolete, dirty, dangerous, and expensive technologies like fossil fuels and nuclear power, or are we going to enter solartopia? That's the question of the moment, and the fight is on.
Well, it is the question of the moment, and I think, Cynthia Papermaster, what you're doing to organize this rate revolt in California is actually going to have unexpected importance because as the old coal-fired and nuclear plants lose more money, they are going to go into legislatures and demand bailouts. We know what's happening in Illinois and Ohio. It will certainly start to happen elsewhere. You know, corporations have no shame, and so they aren't embarrassed by going in and on the one hand, fighting solar, wind, and increased efficiency, and then on the other hand, asking for more money to keep King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas operating. I think we're at the end of the hour. Kevin Camp from Beyond Nuclear, Cynthia Papermaster from Code Pink, thank you so much for being with us and helping us get to Solartopia. We'll have
you
both
back.
another time.
Look forward to having you.
We'll see you next week. Thank you to the crew in New York. We'll see you next week on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Started to burn many things we've found, but don't you know we're gonna have a solar.